This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, now offering Peaberry Especial, a blend of rare pea berries from Colombia, New Guinea, and Tanzania. For a limited time at Pete's retail stores or on the web at Pete's.com.
With our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Fiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Good evening. This is KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 14th. I'm Martha Odom.
And I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner. Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a legislative review panel is studying a proposed ban on the use of alcohol on the floor of the state legislature in Salem. Portland State University's Black Studies Department is starting monthly events on cultural, literary, and political issues. Professor Ethan Johnson will join us live tonight in the studio for a live interview.
Oregon's economic stake in war is higher than it's been since World War II. Lisa Loving brings us part two of the series investigating how much our national addiction to war influences our state.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,311 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 37,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah, since the invasion. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 14th, 2006. I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner.
And I'm Martha Odom. A legislative review panel will study a proposed ban on the use of alcohol on the floor of the state legislature in Salem. The proposal was put forth by Steve Dole of Lake Oswego, the president of Crime Victims United. Dole says he's noticed alcohol on the breasts of some legislators while he was advocating tougher drunken driving penalties at the end of the 2005 session. A panel member, editor Hasso Herring of the Albany Democrat Herald, said he questioned how such a ban would be enforced short of having state police troopers conducting breath tests. Neither Senate nor House rules deals with possession or consumption of alcohol by legislature and staff members. Alcohol is barred from other state buildings but may be permitted in the Capitol with written approval of the legislative administrator and under specific requirements. Just imagine being arrested for legislating under the influence.
Trying to quit smoking? Some local businesses and insurance companies are trying to make it easier. KBOO's Angela Hancock-Revis reports.
The best way to quit smoking may be just a phone call away. A new study in the new edition of Archives of Internal Medicine shows that smokers who receive telephone or personal counseling are over three times more likely to quit than those who just get routine care from doctors. Don Robbins with Oregon's Make It Your Business campaign says that's great news.
If someone is struggling to quit, if they knew that they could triple their chances of success, they may be more likely to pick up the phone.
Robbins says a growing number of Oregon businesses and insurance companies are joining the campaign to provide coverage for tobacco counseling services.
It's cost effective, it works, there's a return on investment, and it improves employee productivity.
Smokers can call 1-800-QUIT-NOW to find local counseling programs. Content provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Angela Hancock-Revis, KBOO News.
The Associated Press reports this week that since the September 11th terrorist attacks on the East Coast, Oregon legislators have approved more than 30 bills putting public records out of the public's reach or limiting public access. Most of the record closings and restrictions stem more from personal privacy concerns and worries about identity theft than fears of terrorism, officials say. Advocates urge the exemptions are undermining Oregon's 1973 public records law that was designed to build people's confidence in government. One of the most hotly debated bills was during the 2003 legislative session when local governments and utilities pushed for a bill banning access to security information about utilities and other important installation from potential sabotage.
Hood River County Schools got the green light to create a dual-language English and Spanish charter school last week. The school board passed the motion by a unanimous vote. The district plans to place the charter school at Westside Elementary School. Response to the parent survey on the issue sent out in January was overwhelmingly positive. District officials said the positive survey responses were almost evenly divided between Hispanic and non-Hispanic families. Marsha LaDuke, assistant superintendent and a member of the dual language administrative team, said that the survey had prompted nearly 500 families to express serious interest in such a school. The immersion school would be able to handle no more than 150 students initially.
Oregon's economic stake in war is higher than it's been since World War II. Around the state, businesses of all kinds are trying to cash in on U.S. Defense Department spending. All this week, KABU News, along with the Portland Alliance newspaper, airs the results of a three-month investigation into how much our national addiction to war influences our state. Today is part two of the series with KABU's Lisa Loving.
U.S. Representative Darlene Hooley describes the role of the Clackamas County-based Pacific Northwest Defense Coalition and the war-related projects they promote.
Oregon, first of all, has literally no military presence, no substantial military presence. We don't have any military bases. So this is a way of doing a couple things. One is it helps create quality jobs in Oregon, and it helps keep our soldiers safer, our country safer. But it is also, these are great projects that sometimes they're developed through the military that have other applications. And sometimes it's other applications that the military can use.
The coalition held its first meetings in January of 2005 after a blitz of organizing, funding, and legislation to establish a cluster of war-related companies in the shopping mall-studded suburban community. The effort started in 2001 when Oregon State Representative Karen Minnis engineered a $200,000 seed grant from state coffers, creating the Oregon Science and Technology Partnership. The partnership is a 501c3 nonprofit with funding from almost every local government within 50 miles of Portland. It also receives funding from the Regional Investment Board and the State Lottery. Its goal is, quote, to provide catalytic leadership to promote and commercialize academic science and technology development. Tom Hartung of the World Policy Institute in New York explains the economic trade-offs of the new local war buildup.
Military spending, for one thing, creates fewer jobs than most other kinds of investment. You'd get probably twice as many jobs if you spent money on education, healthcare, housing, mass transit. Now, some of that is because there's a strata of high-paying jobs within the military sector. But a lot of it has to do with the fact that they have very expensive materials that they use, that the companies make large profits, often cost plus, which means whatever they spend, the government gives them a percentage on top of that. And a lot of these systems, there's no real way to gauge what they're worth. I mean, if you're only building a couple hundred F-22 fighter planes, for example, who's to say what's a fair cost for that? And at the moment, it's over $200 million per plane, which is the most expensive fighter plane ever built. So there's this whole structure in military procurement where the costs are very high, the job payoff is fairly low, and you really don't get much in terms of the future of your economy like you would if you were training people, giving them better education, better job training, and so forth.
Karen Minnis, now Oregon's Speaker of the House, in 2003 sponsored House Bill 2011 to, quote, And sure, we have the business-friendly climate we need to grow and attract 21st-century jobs in Oregon. Representative Hooley remains adamant that U.S. Defense Department contracts are good for Oregon and good for the economy.
For example, a company called Hemcom, they make a bandage that was literally, they showed it to the military. The military said, we are losing men and women because of bleeding to death. We've got the armor vests that they wear, but we lose them when they're shot in the arm or the leg and they bleed to death. And these bandages go on and stop the bleeding immediately, so you don't have to have a tourniquet on it. Well, this has obviously not only application to the military, but it has application to everyone, whether it's in their car or their homes or in hospitals.
KBOO reporter Rabia Yeaman got the scoop on the product from a top Hemcon official at U.S. Senator Gordon Smith's Defense Contractors Fair held at a Portland shopping mall in January.
Okay, well, can I get your name and your company?
Bill Gettler from Hemcon. We're a small company out of Tigard. We make hemorrhage control bandages for severe hemorrhages. Someone's bleeding severely, they put the bandage on. Within a couple of minutes, it stops the bleeding. So it's a very important bandage product for a local area.
And are you currently contracting your product with the government now?
Yes, we are. Currently, we have contracts with the government. We have various government agencies that are buying our product.
And is your product being used overseas?
Definitely. We've had a number of people that have used our product, and their lives have been saved. So we're real proud of our product.
And can I ask approximately how many of these products you have contracted to sell or have already sold to our government?
I don't know that I can give you that number exactly, but it's a large number. And there's going to be more.
In part three of this series, Nanotechnology in Oregon, Dr. Strangelove or Lifesaver. Reporting for KBOO, Stephanie Potter, Martha Odom, Rabia Yeaman, and Lisa Loving.
Oregon officials say the state will no longer participate in a program sponsored by the Mexican consulate to provide information on government programs for immigrants. That's because Mexican officials are limiting the programs to Mexican nationals, a spokesman for the governor said. The program is a mobile service that helps immigrants get a matricula consular, an identification card that's available to Mexican citizens, documented or not, and explains available government services. Kulongoski has spoken favorably of the program, but said last week that the state no longer will participate. The spokesman said that Mexican nationals aren't the only group entitled to outreach, and that the consulate's stance forced the state's hand.
Portland State University's Black Studies Department is starting monthly events on cultural, literary, and political issues. The series starts tomorrow. Here to talk about it is Professor Ethan Johnson. Thank you for joining us. Can you give us some historical background on the PSU Black Studies Department, who started it and when?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm not exactly sure when the Black Studies Department began, but I know it's been around for about 30 years, and Daryl Milner, who is our senior professor in the department, has been there since its inception when it began. And he, today, he is kind of our local scholar about issues and the role of black people and the history of black people in Oregon.
Tell us about the new speaker series. What made you decide to start it, and what do you hope to gain in the community?
Okay. The way I started thinking about this is that, in my perspective, Black Studies departments are supposed to make a connection to the community. And I think, particularly in Portland, it's very important because often I think issues related to black people are not very close to mainstream issues. And so what I am trying to do is make Portland State and the Black Studies Department really a place where scholars, community activists, people who are just working in the black community have a place to come to speak and about issues that they're participating in and trying to address. So
tell us about tomorrow night's speaker and about upcoming events.
Okay. I'm really excited about this event. Tomorrow on Wednesday, March 15th, from 12 to 1:30, we're having Hannah Hurdle Tooley come to speak at this event. What's important about Hannah is that she is the direct descendant of a former slave, and the first thing that I started thinking about was, how is that possible? And I asked her that, and Hannah is 70 years today, 70 years old, when her father had her. He was actually 9 years old, and he was born in 1845. And so she's just going to talk about what it means to her and in her life to be the direct descendant of a former slave. Also, another part of this event is I've also invited Anthony Dyer, who is one of the few black people who is a member of the Portland Chamber of Music, and he's going to play a piece by Beethoven that Beethoven wrote for a black person, and he's going to talk a little bit about that.
That sounds like an exciting event. How can listeners find out more about your events?
Well, they can contact the Black Studies Department, and hopefully KBOO will be announcing our events on a regular basis.
Well, thank you. That was Professor Ethan Johnson of the Portland State University Black Studies Department. Local writer Hannah Hurdle Tooley speaks tomorrow from 12 noon to 1:30 in the Multicultural Center in the Smith Memorial Building, room 228. Food is provided and all are welcome.
The current time is 5:16, and now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Here's a question for Bush and Company. Can any of you even spell hypocrisy? I'm prompted to ask because of back-to-back news items I saw regarding Donnie Rumsfeld's recent jaunt to Moscow. At a press conference, our Pentagon honcho expressed concern about Russian arms sales around the world, sales that the Pentagon calls disruptive weapons technologies. Then, the very next day, Rummy was in Algeria meeting with the country's strongman president, Abdelaziz Bouteflika. Our Pentagon chief was again talking about arms sales, but rather than condemning them, he was trying to make some sales. They have things they desire, and we have things we can be helpful with, Rumsfeld said about a possible arms deal with the Algerian military. Among the high-tech weaponry they want are night vision goggles, helicopters, and fighter planes to help them crack down on anti-government rebels in the country's southern desert. If Rummy's salesmanship has a vague deja vu ring to it, that's because the most infamous instance of his peddling U.S. firepower to the ruler of a desert nation was in 1983. He had been sent to Iraq as a special emissary from Ronald Reagan to assure Saddam Hussein that we would supply him with sophisticated weaponry and help him build up Iraq's military. That didn't work out too well for America. Oh, say the Bushites, this is different, for Bouteflika is our ally against global Islamic terrorism. Hello? Saddam was our ally in 1983. And Bouteflika, who essentially seized power with military backing 7 years ago, has a less than stellar record on human rights and democracy. Once again, Rummy is siding America with power elites and arming them. Indeed, the arms we provide to Bouteflika would be used against his own people and possibly against Algeria's smaller Islamic neighbors. This is Jim Hightower saying, how exactly is this helping America win the hearts and minds of the Islamic world? Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News and Independent Native News following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m., hear Out Loud, followed by Prison Pipeline with host Reggae Bob. At 7, it's Clemmy's Grooves with Clemmy Jones. The weather in Portland, showers likely tonight with a slight chance of evening thunderstorms. Lows are 35 to 40. Tomorrow, cloudy with periods of light rain, high of 47 and low of 41. In Hood River tonight, rain showers are ending with mostly cloudy conditions overnight. The lows will be near 35. A few showers early tomorrow, becoming a steady light rain later in the day with highs of 44 and low around 35. In Salem, showers this evening, becoming less numerous overnight, low 38. Tomorrow, cloudy with some light rain, high of 46 and low of 38. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
The Two Rivers Correctional Institution in Umatilla has created an innovative new program to keep the once frequent brawls in recreation rooms a thing of the past. $35 video game consoles, preloaded with 50 games, are being offered as an incentive for good behavior. Prisoners earn the right to buy one after 18 months of good behavior. Not long ago, prisoners were rewarded for good behavior by getting time off their sentences, but Measure 11's mandatory sentence for violent crimes ended that incentive for 40% of the state's inmates. The motivational strategies to replace physical violence with virtual seem to be working. In the past 3 years, misconduct reports, assaults on staff, and inmate fights have declined slightly, even as the state's prison population jumped from nearly 12,000 to more than 13,000.
The abortion rate is down in Oregon. From 1998 through 2004, the number of procedures in the state fell about 20%. The year 2004 is the last for which the Department of Human Services has a full year of data. Abortion in Oregon law passed in 1969 preceded the U.S. Supreme Court Roe v. Wade ruling legalizing abortion nationally. Oregon has one of the oldest and least restrictive laws in the nation, with none of the limits that exist in many states. Nevertheless, women outside the I-5 corridor often must travel long distances to find a provider. Planned Parenthood of the Columbia Willamette runs clinics that offer abortions in Portland, Beaverton, Gresham, Bend, Salem, and Vancouver. NARAL Pro-Choice America, a national abortion rights group, ranks Oregon seventh among states on legal and geographic access to abortion. California ranks number one, Washington number two, and South Dakota number 47.
Washington State Representative Rodney Tom of Bellevue is converting from a Republican into a Democrat. He'll challenge State Senate Republican floor leader Luke Esser this fall from the other side of the aisle. Tom says Esser and the legislative Republicans, quote, have moved so far right they no longer represent the interests of mainstream voters. Tom is now in his second term in the House. He broke with his conservative caucus on gay civil rights, simple majority approval of school levies, and last year's gas tax hike. Democrats currently control the state Senate 26-23. The party has been making inroads in the once solidly Republican Seattle East Side suburbs.
In a dispute over law enforcement practices on the Columbia River, the Yakima Nation has withdrawn from the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission and revoked the commission's jurisdiction over tribal members. The Portland-based commission was formed by the Yakima, Warm Springs, Umatilla, and Nez Perce tribes nearly three decades ago to help the tribes set fishing regulations and protect treaty rights, habitat, and the commission's 11 officers commissioned by the tribes as police officers in Washington and Oregon patrol about 300 miles of river between Bonneville and McNary Dams.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 14th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. Or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K26AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Angela Hancock-Revis and Jim Thompson. Tonight's audio editor is Margot Considine. Special thanks to reporters Lisa Loving, Angela Hancock-Revis, and Marlies Franklin. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Isaac Kaplan-Wolner.
And I'm Martha Odom. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News, followed by Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, it's Talk Radio with guest Kelly Campbell of the American Friends Service Committee, as well as an Iraqi human rights activist touring the country. At 9, it's Veterans Voice with Northwest Veterans for Peace. At 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller continues, It Is Happening Here, his year-long series on fascism in the United States, with a look at the identification of enemies and scapegoats as a unifying principle. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored commuter radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, March 14, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, oil executives defend their record-breaking profits before a Senate committee.
While each of you might be accused of making your companies making quite a bit of money, that is not yet a crime in America.
And we'll check in on the ongoing struggle to save the nation's largest urban garden, the South Central Farm. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
From WBAI in New York, I'm Mitch Jezerich with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Over 85 bodies killed in execution-style shootings have been found in Baghdad in the last day and a half. At least 27 bodies were stacked in a mass grave in a Shiite neighborhood. Cleric Muqtada al-Sadr is calling for calm and says that his Mehdi army would not retaliate. Some analysts are saying that only the rapid formation of a unity Iraqi government could ebb the hostility. So far, that has been a difficult feat as the new government has delayed the inaugural session since the December 15th elections were confirmed more than a month ago. 4 days after former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic was found dead in a cell, Serbian leaders have paved the way for his burial in Serbia. Jackson Allers has more from Montenegro.
Marko Milosevic, the son of former Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic, arrived today in the Netherlands to collect his father's body. He accused The Hague of murder for not respecting his father's request to be sent to Moscow for medical treatment of hypertension. Milosevic's son was accompanied by a group of Russian forensic experts. The Russian government contends it does not trust the Dutch autopsy report. Milosevic died of a heart attack on Saturday, just months before a verdict was due in his 4-year trial for genocide and 66 counts of war crimes in Bosnia, Croatia, and Kosovo. The former president's widow, Mira Markovic, was given clearance to attend the funeral if it is held in Serbia. She is wanted on charges of state abuse of power and has had a warrant for arrest since fleeing to Moscow in 2003. It is unclear whether the funeral will be held in Serbia or whether it will be held in Moscow, something that is conditioned on what Milosevic's son says is the safety of his mother. Milosevic's old party, the Socialist Party of Serbia, is pressuring Serbian Prime Minister Vojislav Kostunica and the Serbian government to allow family members the right to visit his grave after any funeral proceedings. Tensions within the government have been heightened recently due to status negotiations with Kosovo. Serbian authorities have ruled out a state funeral. For FSRN with Zoran Chulovic, this is Jackson Allers reporting from Serbia, Montenegro.
Maoist rebels in eastern India temporarily seized a train and then set free its passengers. Benu Alex has more.
Maoist rebels in the Indian state of Jharkhand captured a train yesterday and then fled the scene without harming any passenger, apparently to prove the point that they can undertake such actions. The rebels freed the passengers after almost 12 hours and left the area. Jharkhand, 1,200 kilometers southeast of New Delhi, is dominated by India's indigenous people. Mostly poor, though the region is rich in minerals and forest resources. More than 6,000 people have died during the rebels' 20-year fight for a communist state in the areas around Jharkhand. A few of the 300 passengers said the rebels told them that their fight was against the establishment and therefore would not harm them. Mine blasts, killing of paramilitary forces and guerrilla fights are common in the area where the government is now trying to mobilize self-defense groups to counter the Maoists. From Ahmedabad in India, I'm Binu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
In El Salvador, both major political parties are claiming victory in Sunday's elections for the coveted mayor's position in the capital of San Salvador. With just over 80% of the vote counted, Violeta Manivar, the leftist FMLN, is running ahead of Rodrigo Samoya of the right-wing Arena. However, in congressional elections, Arena holds a slight lead over the FMLN that would, if held, give Arena two more seats than the FMLN in Congress. Arena has not received enough votes, however, to gain a congressional majority. It has been confirmed that a third case of mad cow disease has been found in the U.S. This comes as the U.S. is attempting to allay international fears of U.S. beef. Selena Masuda reports from Washington.
At a press conference, the USDA's chief veterinary officer, John Clifford, says U.S. beef is safe and that the positive mad cow disease confirmation should not impact negotiations with South Korea or Japan. Both countries have closed their beef markets to the United States.
We have effective safeguards in the U.S. and the ruminant feed ban, as well as SRM removal. So we would not anticipate that it would affect trade.
According to a private veterinarian who killed the cow after it collapsed on an Alabama farm, the cow is about 10 years old, making it born before the United States banned all feed containing cattle parts. No parts of the cow were introduced into the human or animal food supply. However, since the cow lived on an Alabama dairy farm for less than a year, the USDA will look for the cow's farm of origin, including an investigation to find its calves and original herd. Selena Masuda, FSRN in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Mitch Jezerich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
Oil executives defended their record high profits before a Senate Judiciary Committee today, saying that consumers absorbed the increased costs of record oil and natural gas prices and that consolidation of the oil industry is necessary to compete. Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
Audience members stood in the back of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing room wearing T-shirts reading Expose Exxon. ExxonMobil has said in the past that they don't invest in alternative energy sources. At the committee hearing on energy consolidation and gas prices, Democratic Senator from New York, Charles Schumer, questioned Exxon CEO Rex Tillerson about this.
Senator, I think your question is, are we investing heavily in alternatives? And
you're
we
not.
Are not. We are investing
right.
in technology, and we are investing heavily in conventional oil and natural gas, which is the business we are in. Mm-hmm. We are not in those other businesses.
Right. Okay.
Several senators questioned why the companies earned record profits in 2005. Republican Senator John Cornyn from Texas, whose second biggest campaign contributor is the oil and gas industry, defended the company's income.
I must say, while each of you might be accused of making your companies making quite a bit of money, that is not yet a crime in America.
But others are concerned that ExxonMobil earned $36 billion last year and British Petroleum earned $22 billion. Democratic Senator Herb Cole from Wisconsin questions the oil executives.
As the price of raw materials rises to a record level, every business I know loses money or doesn't make the profits it wants to make, unless it's able to pass that on directly to consumers, which in most competitive industries is not easily done.
Tillerson, ExxonMobil CEO, responds.
Your description is correct. The high price of crude oil has been passed ultimately along to the consumer.
And I appreciate that. And I'm also then pointing out what we know here is that your ability to pass that on to consumers has been so successful that at least in this past year, you've made more money than you or any other company has ever made before.
In 1991, the five largest oil companies controlled 27% of the nation's gasoline stations. In 2005, the top five controlled 61%. Concerned about the lack of competition within the oil and gas industry, Senator Cole introduced legislation that he co-authored that would give antitrust law enforcement additional means to restore competition to the industry. The lack of federal enforcement of antitrust law is one reason companies are able to consolidate, which diminishes competition. It also keeps prices higher for consumers. That's according to several witnesses at the Senate hearing. Joseph Alioto is an attorney who testified. He said private citizens need to have the right to sue oil and gas companies.
The government, I would say in many of the antitrust cases in the last 10 years, the government is on the side of the defendant. So the private right of action is the only one that is being effective.
The chair of the Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter, is also drafting legislation that aims to limit oil and gas company tactics that enable them to increase their profit margin. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
Six Palestinian fighters inside a West Bank prison in Jericho have surrendered to Israeli forces almost 10 hours after Israeli troops laid siege to the compound Tuesday morning. Leila Al-Haddad has more from Gaza.
With tanks, bulldozers, and helicopter gunships, Israeli military forces besieged the Palestinian prison in the otherwise sleepy desert town, ultimately seizing six of its most wanted inmates holed up inside. Most prominent among them, Ahmed Saadat, head of the Marxist Palestinian Front for the Liberation of Palestine and implicated for his organization's involvement in the assassination of an Israeli tourist minister in 2002. In an unusual arrangement that involved the United States and Britain, Saadat had been held in a Palestinian prison for the past 4 years without ever standing trial. Yasser Arafat agreed to imprison Mr. Saadat and five other wanted men in Jericho rather than hand them over to Israel in return for Israel ending its siege of his compound in 2002. As part of the arrangement, Britain and the United States supplied monitors who kept watch on Palestinian prisoners in Jericho. Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian president, said earlier today that he held Britain and the United States responsible for the Israeli raid of the Jericho prison. The monitors left their posts early this morning, citing concerns for their safety in a letter several days earlier. The Israelis arrived shortly after they evacuated the area, prompting criticism that the two sides were colluding together against the PA. In what many critics regarded as a pre-election stunt, the Israeli government seized Saadat after the day-long showdown, which involved the surrender and stripping down of hundreds of Palestinian security guards in front of television cameras. The PFLP, like Mahmoud Abbas, held foreign powers responsible for failing to protect Palestinian prisoners and breaking their agreements with the PA. Khalid Jarrar is a member of the PFLP currently serving in the Palestinian parliament.
As a Palestinian, I felt very demoralized by what happened. The whole thing was very humiliating. These are political prisoners being held inside a Palestinian prison, and he attacked them with tanks and helicopters as if they were armed. This demonstrates that such agreements that are signed with the Israelis, with so-called American and British monitors, do not guarantee the safety and lives of the prisoners. And the Israeli occupation will continue with its policies regardless. Only by bringing an end to the occupation can we as Palestinians truly be protected.
Angry protests erupted in Gaza shortly after word of the raid broke out. The protests were followed by a spate of kidnappings in Gaza and the West Bank. Nine foreigners were kidnapped. Five of them remained in custody by the end of the day, including four French aid workers and one South Korean journalist. A spokesman for the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades has given Israel and the United States 12 hours to release Saadat and vowed not to release the abductees. Also today, Israel completely sealed off the Gaza Strip, closing down the Al-Mintar commercial crossing only days after it was reopened and shutting down Rafah Terminal, Gaza's only outlet to the outside world. For FSRN in Gaza, this is Leila Al-Haddad.
Iraq is preparing for the Shiite holiday of Arba'in in the wake of attacks that killed at least 46 people in Baghdad's Shiite enclaves of Sadr City on Sunday. As the instability in Iraq continues, residents are finding it increasingly difficult to get out of the country, and in the case of at least one member of the new Iraqi parliament, he's not planning on going back anytime soon. FSRN's David Enders files this report from Amman, Jordan.
Mustafa al-Hiti, who won a seat in the new parliament with the Iraqi Dialogue Front, will not be in parliament when it opens on Thursday.
Well, at the moment, I don't like, really. Because you don't have any kind of power to force the law in anywhere, in any administration or any ministry. So it is very difficult, really, to work in such an environment.
Hidi visited Baghdad before the bombing of the Askariya Shrine last month and found the capital seemingly preparing for things to get worse.
I found the city really very horrible. At 6 o'clock, everything is closed. You have to go back, what you call it, like a city of ghosts. People, they feel very insecure.
Hidi is fortunate. He has residency in Jordan, a place where more than 100,000 Iraqis have fled since the invasion 3 years ago. Bombings carried out by Iraqis in November in Amman and the arrest of more Iraqis accused of planning bombings has led to an increase in deportations of those who overstay visas, and now Iraqis say that as a rule, they are only allowed 3-day transit visas when entering Jordan. Fayez Al-Khali owns a hotel near one of the main garages used by cars transporting Iraqis back and forth between Baghdad and Amman.
That's all of Jordanian business, not only me.
In Amman, I'm David Enders reporting for FSRN.
The case that pitted Google against the U.S. Department of Justice was heard in federal court today, where it was revealed that the private information Google gathers from its users' daily web activity may no longer be entirely private. The data that the government was seeking may now be used in a much bigger case known as the ACLU versus Gonzalez, which is set to be heard later this year. FSRN's Eric Klein has more.
The Department of Justice was initially seeking information about millions of Google searches. It requested and received similar information from AOL, Yahoo, and Microsoft, although the exact nature of what was handed over is not known. Google was the only major search engine that stood up to the Bush administration Department of Justice. Google was resisting the subpoena on the grounds that the information the government would receive about Google users was irrelevant to the issues in ACLU versus Gonzalez, and on the grounds that it would be a huge burden for Google to produce the information, also that Google would have to reveal some trade secrets in order to comply. Rebecca Jessica is the spokesperson with the Electronic Frontiers Foundation. EFF is an institutional plaintiff in ACLU versus Gonzalez.
We definitely are very glad that Google has decided to stand up for its users' privacy rights. But an important thing to note is that if Google didn't keep this information, the government wouldn't be able to subpoena it. All your search queries are sitting there in a history in Google like a big honeypot just waiting for investigators to get at it.
The DOJ was seeking the information on internet use for evidence in the pending ACLU versus Gonzalez case, and scaled back their initial request for millions of searches to just 5,000 random search requests from the Google database. Chris Hansen is a staff lawyer at the National Office of the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU has sued the federal government over the federal law known as the Children Online Protection Act. The ACLU says that COPPA is unconstitutional.
COPPA is a law that makes it a crime to engage in speech that is harmful to minors on the Internet. Speech that is harmful to minors is speech that is about sex and everyone agrees is constitutionally protected for adults. The problem with banning harmful to minors speech on the Internet is that it means that even adults who are entitled to see that speech will not be able to do so. And we think the Internet ought not to be dumbed down in the name of protecting children and prevent adults from having access to information they want. In addition, we think that there are much better and more effective alternatives to protect children on the Internet, namely filtering products.
The constitutionality of COPPA has been heard by the Supreme Court twice since 1998. On the most recent occasion, the Supreme Court said COPPA was likely to be found unconstitutional, but sent the case back for trial, which is what the ACLU and the Gonzalez Justice Department are preparing for now. The case will be heard this fall in Pennsylvania, and it appears as though some of the data from Google will now be used as evidence. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
Haiti's interim prime minister, Gerard Latartu, traveled to Canada a few days ago to meet with high-level Canadian officials. His visit included a stop in Ottawa on March 10 to meet with Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper behind closed doors. And on March 11, Latartu met with Quebec's Prime Minister Jean Chrétien at Chrétien's office in Montreal.
Lachartou was appointed Haiti's prime minister after the February 2004 coup d'etat against then-president Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Although Lachartou's ascension to power was in contravention to Haiti's own constitution. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has more.
In Montreal, a group of around 75 people from the Haitian community and their supporters held a lively rally in front of Jean Charest's office to protest Gerard Lachartou's visit. While the details of his visit to Canada have been kept from the public, many activists are speculating that the purpose is for Canada to take control over many of Haiti's public services before their new president-elect, René Garcia-Préval, comes to power. The Canadian Foundation for Latin America, FOCAL, developed a plan in April 2004, which would effectively see Quebec oversee Haiti's education ministry. Marie-Claire Jumel of the group Haitian Resistance of Quebec offers her views on Lachartou's visit.
For me, it's because they had a focal plan to put into practice. Maybe it's this focal plan that they're busy deliberating over, but what they're saying is that even if Lachartou has signed the papers, we disagree because Lachartou is not the president of the republic elected by the people. We have Mr. Préval, who was elected by the people, and it's with him that we must all sign the papers, not Lachartou.
In recent weeks, Lachartou has made other trips abroad to sign important agreements on Haiti's future. Nick Barry Shaw, an organizer with Haiti Action Montreal, explains a recent deal struck by Lachartou and MINUSTAH, the United Nations Stabilization Mission in Haiti.
So February 22nd, he's in New York City, and he signs an agreement with the UN stipulating that MINUSTAH will have the final say in any sort of changes that are to be made to the personnel or to the organization of Haiti's national police, effectively putting the Haitian national police under a tutorship of MINUSTAH.
Préval, who was declared the next president of Haiti after the February 7th elections, came to power amidst much chaos and controversy at the polling stations. His inauguration has now been delayed indefinitely until the legislative elections are held. Meanwhile, social problems persist in Haiti. Guy Romer, the editor-in-chief of Haiti Progrès.
The fight is still on because you have the parliamentary election. They have been reported for after the June 19 and so on. They are trying anyway to put Préval like a puppet president, so he won't have any power. But Préval should now say a good gesture. I mean, they should free the political prisoners. I think so, definitely. This is a main question.
In Montreal, protesters handed out warrants for Lachartou's arrest, citing his involvement in crimes against humanity, including police massacres, politically motivated incarcerations, and condoning paramilitary violence. Many saw this visit as Canada's attempt to consolidate its power in the coup d'etat that it helped to finance in Haiti 2 years ago. This is Aaron Lakoff reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Montreal, Canada.
Jay Benish, an Aurora, Colorado geography teacher from Overland High School, has returned to class after nearly 2 weeks of close public scrutiny about comments he made during a recent lecture. Maria Collier has more from Denver, Colorado.
I would just like to say to everyone that I'm very excited to be back in the classroom on Monday. I'm very excited to continue encouraging students to think critically, to encourage democratic values in our society, and to promote social justice, just as I have always attempted to do. And I just want to say once again thank you to all of my friends, colleagues, students, and people all across the country who have contacted me with their support. I really appreciate all that.
After comments Benish made during a lecture were taped in part by 16-year-old student Sean Allen and released to the media, Benish took a paid administrative leave while the district investigated to see if there had been a breach of its policy requiring teachers to show balance in their presentation of topics. In the 21-minute portion of the lecture Allen taped the day after President Bush's State of the Union address, Benish's views were predominant. He spoke out against U.S. foreign policy and the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq and said that President Bush's tone during the address sounded similar to that of Adolf Hitler. However, he claims that the portion of the lecture that wasn't recorded would have shown that it was a balanced presentation of material. After Allen's father released the taped recording to a Denver-area talk show host, media coverage expanded stirring up national debate about the limits of a teacher's freedom of speech in a classroom. The Cherry Creek School District determined Friday that Benish would be allowed to return to his classroom this week. His attorney, David Lane, admitted that his client will probably be a bit more fair and balanced on a minute-to-minute basis instead of looking at a course as being balanced from a semester's perspective. Superintendent Monte Moses said the district would be working closely with Benish to assure there would be adherence to all school district policies.
We have a good understanding between Mr. Benish and the district about what's expected. Mr. Benish has a complete report of the investigation with our suggestions and recommendations contained therein.
When asked how his teaching style will change as a result of the controversy, Benish said he believed it would affect him and others across the country.
I am feeling a little bit as though this is, to an extent, a measure of censure, and I believe that this will stifle classroom discussion across the country, and I'm very concerned about the polarization that is facing American society today, and I think this is an issue that is much broader and bigger than I am and is something that our society is going to have to deal with in the future.
In Denver, Colorado, I'm Maria Cecile Collier for Free Speech Radio News.
Members and supporters of the nation's largest urban garden, the South Central Farm in Los Angeles, wrapped up an eventful week, culminating in what organizers call a political reprieve from imminent eviction. The farmers have been battling what they call an illegal land sale of their farmland to developer Ralph Horowitz, who intends to destroy the garden to make way for a warehouse. KPFK's Kelly Barnes reports.
Farmers received word Thursday evening of the reprieve while a spokesperson was on Pacifica Radio's LA affiliate KPFK. Rosa Romero learned the city would help stave off eviction during a period of negotiation among the city, the Trust for Public Land, and developer Ralph Horowitz. The next morning at City Hall, environmental activist Julia Butterfly Hill talked about the struggle of the farmers bringing her to the Southland to participate in any civil disobedience deemed necessary to save the farm.
I was really excited to rabble-rouse and cause a little trouble, but I'm even more excited that there's been a reprieve and that that's not necessary at this time.
The Trust for Public Land is attempting to negotiate a community trust for the 14-acre garden so the farmers can stay on the land and continue to be a public space for the community. Teza Zomok of the South Central Farmers Support Coalition on what the recent developments mean.
We are making progress. We have to be vigilant. The city's made some commitments and we're giving them some room to negotiate.
However, spokesperson Dele Aylman says the temporary eviction reprieve is only a political arrangement. It has not stopped all the actions in the legal process of eviction.
One thing we know for sure is that the political organizing that we are engaged in on the street is beginning to show results. That we know.
As proof of that effectiveness, the farmers have recently been slapped with a $700,000 lawsuit by Horowitz for abuse of process or for not going quietly from the land they have tilled for 14 years. Meanwhile, the farmers report that the Los Angeles Police Department has been aggressively ticketing cars parked outside the farm. The farm has also come under more intense helicopter surveillance by the L.A. County Sheriff's Department. Witnesses report the helicopter engaging in drills where ropes were dropped from the aircraft in preparation, they say, for forcibly removing protesters from the site. L.A. County Sheriff's media advisors would not comment on the helicopters or purpose of the ropes. Friday's strong showing by the farmers and their supporters began with public comment at the opening of the meeting of the L.A. City Council. The farmers have been pleading their case to the council for 3 years. After protests at Horowitz's gated community last Wednesday, followed by a late-canceled protest at the mayor's mansion Thursday, the public comment period was moved up 1 hour earlier this Friday for unknown reasons. Just outside City Hall, at least 250 protesters carried the message to downtown workers and journalists. In between green lights, protesters dressed as fruits, vegetables, and sheriff's vehicles performed street theater. They presented the case of the farmers in a 30-second nutshell to the amusement of morning commuters. Teza Zomok called the theater cathartic. Later at their press conference, Zach De La Rocha, musician and poet, former singer with Rage Against the Machine, delivers a message to city politicians the farmers feel have been inactive.
It's my opinion that Mr. Horowitz simply isn't proposing to build a warehouse. He is building a powder keg.
And if there is no intervention in the interests of these families, the city government may be lighting the fuse.
One reason the city has been so inactive, according to the farmers, is the large campaign contributions to the office of the city attorney by developer Ralph Horowitz. Jesus Ramirez of La Causa delivers his message to the city council on why this fight for the nation's largest urban garden is so pivotal.
I don't want to go back to the 80s, like movies of colors and Boys in the Hood, where we can go all over the world and say, yes, I am from South Central, and people cringe and say that is an unlivable place.
For FSRN in LA, I'm Kelly Barnes of the People Without Borders Collective.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News in Los Angeles. I'm Aura Bogado.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, March 14, 2006. I'm Robert Hannon in for Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. The law might be running thin on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Reservation by next month. A federal grant that expires on April 1st could mean layoffs for two-thirds of the Pine Ridge police force. INN's Charles Michael Ray has more.
Pine Ridge could lose 59 out of its 88 patrol officers unless money is found to make up for the loss of the federal COPS grant, which expires at the end of the month.
We are fighting. We're doing whatever we can to keep our law enforcement program.
Pine Ridge Police Chief Ron Duke says the tribe is diligently working to restore funding in order to avoid losing so many officers.
I mean, it's going to put a big burden on the law enforcement if this happens. The coverage now is very minimal with the 88 officers we have on duty. Once we lose these positions, it's going to be hectic around here trying to find coverage for the 440-some square miles that we have to cover.
Duke says the tribal administration has succeeded in securing some federal funds that could save about 11 officers from layoff, but he says much more will be needed to offset the entire loss. Charles Michael Ray, Rapid City, South Dakota.
People in Wisconsin who want to eliminate Native American logos and mascots from their public schools are hopeful, even though one school board in the central part of the state voted last month to keep theirs. Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio reports.
The school board in the central Wisconsin community of Mosinee voted again to keep calling its sports teams the Indians. Those in favor say the nickname honors Native Americans, but not everyone agrees. Barb Munson is a member of the Oneida Tribe who chairs the Indian Mascot and Logo Task Force for the Wisconsin Indian Education Association. Her daughter, Christine, attended Mosinee High School at a time when the Chippewa in Wisconsin were asserting their spearfishing treaty rights.
People were talking about spearing a squaw and saving two walleyes, so it was a very uncomfortable environment for an American Indian person to be in.
Munson is disappointed with the Mosinee School Board vote, but sees progress in its narrow 5-4 margin.
I believe that Indian mascots and logos will be eliminated from all Wisconsin schools. I think it's just a matter of time.
Munson notes that Elizabeth Burmaster is the third state school superintendent to call for an end to Indian mascots. Meanwhile, legislation to abolish them statewide has stalled in the General Assembly. In Wausau, Wisconsin, I'm Glenn Moberg.
Southeast Alaska Native groups are gearing up for their every other year cultural gathering. Celebration 06 will take place May 31st through June 4th in Juneau's Centennial Hall. As Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld tells us, it's expected to attract up to 5,000 dancers, artists, speakers, and visitors.
Celebration 06 will include dozens of stage performances by Tlingit Haida and Tsimshian song and dance groups. Celebration coordinator Bob Hamilton says this year's event includes a focus on some of its youngest participants. Many dancers and attendees carry young children dressed in ceremonial garb. Hamilton says Celebration 2006 will recognize that tradition.
Each celebration we have a theme, and the theme this year is reflections of our ancestors in the faces of our children. And to kind of highlight that, we're having a baby regalia review. And that's children up to age 2 can participate in traditional regalia.
The event will also include a black seaweed competition. Yaro Barra, another of the event's organizers, says dried seaweed is a traditional food throughout the region, but different groups prepare it in different ways.
It's surprising the difference in taste between the seaweeds, between where it's prepared or where it's grown from. It's very interesting. It's been a lot of fun.
Celebration takes place May 31st through June 4th in Juneau. More information is online at www.sealaskaheritage.org. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Robert Hanlon.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C., defending Native American interests since 1976. And by Ridolfi Incorporated, designing and implementing restorative community development. RIDOLFI.com.
Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.